It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios in La Crosse. We're continuing this week with our coverage of COVID-19, and this time I'm going to start across the river in Winona County, Minnesota, part of our listening area here in the southwestern region of Wisconsin. And Winona County has had a number of cases, and unlike La Crosse County, unfortunately, several people have died from the coronavirus in Winona County. We're joined now for an update by Karen Sanis, who is the Director of Health and Human Services for Winona County. First of all, Karen, thank you very much for taking time from your schedule to join us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
So give us just a bit of a snapshot of COVID-19 in Winona County. We're used to kind of hearing the rundown of how many cases you have, how many of those have led to unfortunate fatalities, you know, the different how many tests are being done, that kind of thing. So give us the rundown for Winona County.
We have currently 66 cases of positive COVID tests. And then we've had 15 deaths due to COVID all came out of a long-term care facility within our county. This long-term care facility is on our the Minnesota Department of Health's website as a congregate care facility that has COVID infections. So I'm not releasing any information. I can't. So the facility is Sauer Healthcare. They have provided Winona County with quality care for our elderly population for over 50 years, and it's just a really sad incident that has happened within that facility. Majority of cases, over half the cases, positive cases within Winona County have come out of that facility. And we are just continuing to work with the Minnesota Department of Health to continue to try and control and contain the virus within that facility and within our communities.
That facility, as you mentioned, and we'll get to more specifics on that in a moment, but that accounts for a lot of what's going on. Outside of that facility, would you say, aside from that particular outbreak, that the rest of the statistics coming from Winona County are more in line with what we're finding in the rest of the counties in our region?
I would say yes, it is consistent what we're finding as far as the community spread within Winona County, that it is consistent with the other counties within Minnesota and Wisconsin. We started a collaborative group between Minnesota, Houston County, and then Elmaquie County in Iowa, and several of the Wisconsin counties, kind of our regional tri-state area. And we meet weekly, just talk about our cases, and it seems to be consistent across the boards with positive cases.
Now, I know a lot of those conversations must be kind of down to business, but what has that been like to be able to both receive support and offer support from your counterparts in other counties and even in other states?
It's been really great because we do services in Minnesota through public health very differently than they do them in Wisconsin and the way they do them in Iowa. So it's been kind of a really neat experience talking with the other public health leaders within our region to be able to talk about the differences between our states and things that they've tried and things that have worked well and things that they've tried and haven't worked well. You know, don't go down this route, but you should probably do this. Has been very, very helpful. So we've really, the group has been a great support to one another, and we've really enjoyed the collaboration between all of the counties.
In Wisconsin, for the last several weeks, a month or so, we've been under what's being called a safer at home order, which is kind of just a slight downgrade from a shelter in place order. Where essential businesses are still able to offer services and people, as long as they're not congregating, are encouraged to stay home but allowed to go take care of some of those necessary responsibilities that they have to do. What has the situation been for in the recent few weeks in Minnesota? What kind of orders are in place there?
We have a stay-at-home order, which is similar to what Wisconsin has. We have recently, all essential services have been open. Of course, bars and restaurants and non-essential services are closed. Governor Walz did loosen some of those regulations within the last executive order that he issued to allow some other, you know, factories, and other non-essential businesses to open because due to the economic impact, but they have to follow some very strict guidelines as far as taking temperatures, assuring that people are practicing social distancing, additional cleaning within their facilities or within their places of business, just some pretty, you know, the basic stuff that we've been talking about, but just really making sure that those strategies are in place for that infection control.
I want to circle back to the facility in Winona County that has kind of been the epicenter for your region in terms of the cases of COVID-19 and also, unfortunately, all of the deaths that you've experienced. And the interesting thing, and I think the important thing to highlight is that, as you mentioned before, this is not a facility that that is known for, you know, playing fast and loose with the rules or anything like that. This is a quality care provider, and highlights just how quickly widespread an illness like COVID-19 can become. Talk a little bit about how you became aware of the cases that were going on in that place and what was unusual about it.
Well, what's unusual is that, you know, when we first got our first case back on April, I think 23rd was our first case that we got, it was announced. The facility themselves notified us. We hadn't even been notified by the Minnesota Department of Health yet of a positive case within our county. And the facility themselves had contacted several of our staff and then several of our other community providers because they share employees. So we were notified early on of the facility, and it was made very public very early on. So they wanted to provide transparency about what was going on in their facility. And so then when, you know, we in Winona County or within the state of Minnesota, we are a state-supervised and county-administered program, which is kind of different from Wisconsin. We take all of our direction from the Minnesota Department of Health, and we don't have as much local control as Wisconsin does with their local public health. So we really rely on the state of Minnesota to provide that direction to us. So within that, they had provided a case manager to work with the facility to work on infection control and mitigation strategies. And they just couldn't get the virus contained within the facility.
It was rather unusual, the step that came about when they decided they just had to test everyone at the facility, because we've heard all along how tests are hard to come by, and so the criterion for who is tested have to be set pretty strictly. But it wasn't until they began testing everybody at the facility that it was discovered just how many asymptomatic people who had no signs of being ill, actually had and were passing along coronavirus.
That is correct, Ezra. We had they just determined that they were going to test everybody within the facility because they had, you know, our local hospital brought, you know, assisted with their infection control experts and everything, and they just could not get the virus contained. And so they tested everybody from, you know, custodians to all the residents within the facility. And even the people that had already tested positive, they were testing them again just to see if there was reinfection or anything else. Out of that testing of everybody within the facility, 21 individuals came back positive that were asymptomatic. They had no signs or symptoms of the COVID virus and were actively contagious.
So once again, this falls right along with what we've been hearing from other public health professionals over the weeks and the last month and a half or so about how careful people need to be, because a lot of people look around and say, I don't know anybody who has been sick, and I myself have not been sick, and so I'm not at risk, and the people that I know are not at risk. But that's not the case, is it?
No, it's not. People that are asymptomatic could be at the grocery store picking up groceries. They could be walking on the same path as you. They can, you know, potentially touch something that you touch next and not even know that they're infected with the COVID-19 virus.
I don't know if this falls in your department or not, but when you've had a bunch of concentrated cases like that, and yet care still needs to be given to the people in that facility, and there's a lot of work that employees who are left there still need to do, and yet that heightened level of concern because of what's happened. What resources might be available for those people who have been through that? Do those employees have resources they can rely on in terms of mental health resources or anything like that?
Yeah, there are some mental health resources available to some of our individuals. They're starting to roll out more and more of those services, and as they become available, we'll be sharing that with the facility or anybody that has worked with COVID-19 patients. Just because it does take a toll on people's mental health. They were struggling with staffing at some point during this outbreak at the facility, and they really, so we were trying to really brainstorm as to how can we support them, and trying to get, nurses that had been furloughed, from Winona Health or the different medical facilities in the area to see if they would be able to come in and provide that additional staffing and support. And so we've been working on that right now to try and assist them with getting that staffing levels that they need.
The facility where most of the cases have or where a lot of the cases have been centered, are there still people living there, or have those residents been moved elsewhere?
They are. All of the people that have tested positive are still at the facility. All the individuals that tested negative, they did move them to a different facility within Winona. It is a facility that has a blocked-off wing in the facility that has no contact with the other residents of that facility. So they were able to move all, I think it was 14 residents, over to the facility within Winona, to kind of get that separation, and then doing surveillance testing on those individuals regularly to see if they do ever test positive for the COVID-19 virus.
As we bring this conversation to a close, what words would you like to leave with listeners in Winona County, across the river in Wisconsin, and throughout our region?
Sure. I would really like to express that, people look to public health, and they look to, their state's public health departments to provide direction and wanting to know that something is being done. The people that have control over this virus are the people that live in our communities. They are the ones that can control the spread of this virus by staying home, not having contact, non-essential contact with people, not sneaking over the neighbors and visiting and things like that. They're the ones that control this virus. We don't have control over that. So they are our people in our communities are the ones that that have the power to contain this.
Karen Sanis, the Director of Health and Human Services in Winona County, thank you very much for the information that you've shared today and for joining us on the program. I appreciate your time.
I really appreciate the opportunity to provide some education to the community.
Certainly. And this is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. If you'd like to find out more about our program, you can do that on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. You can listen to this and other episodes on demand. You can subscribe to our podcast by opening your favorite podcasting app, searching for Newsmakers, and hitting subscribe. We'd be very pleased to have you do that. Coming up later in today's program, we're talking to Senator Jennifer Schilling as she wraps up her 20-year legislative career. That's coming up later. Next, the health department from Trempealeau County joins us with an update. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. We're continuing our weeks-long coverage of COVID-19 and the different ways that our region has been responding to the necessities that it creates. We're joined now by Kayla Baer, who's with the Trempealeau County Health Department. She's the Public Health Nutrition Coordinator for the Trempealeau County Health Department. Kayla, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Ezra.
So for those not familiar, within our regional listening area, Trempealeau County is just about as far north as we go, and we haven't heard very much from that part of the world since COVID-19 started. So why don't you start by giving us a little bit of a snapshot of where your community stands in terms of how many cases of COVID-19 you've had and how that's kind of been affecting your part of the world.
So we've had very few cases of COVID-19 here in Trempealeau County, only two to date at this point, and one of those cases has recovered. Yesterday, we were at 469 negative COVID-19 tests in the county. So with a county of about 30,000, that's not very much, kind of like the rest of Wisconsin, where we're not testing quite as much as they would probably like us to be. Just because we have two cases doesn't mean that we haven't been very busy with responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. Our nurses have been hard at work with contact tracing, making sure that anyone who did have a positive and was in contact with someone will be contacted, and also just communicating how to stay safe from the virus.
Contact tracing is something that those of us in journalism who have talked about over the years about infectious, different kinds of diseases like HIV and those kinds of things are used to talking to people about contact tracing. Talk about how that works in a county health department that doesn't have very many resources to spread around.
At this point, our public health nurses and our public health staff have been able to handle the contact tracing, so that's really been a positive. I can't speak to what the plans are, as we move forward, if there's more tracing that needs to be done beyond kind of what the state has already discussed, actually.
We have just a couple of cases in Trempealeau County that have been confirmed, but in a lot of counties, what we're hearing is that because testing may not be as widespread or may not even be available to some people, there are some cases that they're saying, well, we're sure there are more cases than that. We don't have the means to find all of them. Is that the case in Trempealeau County as well?
Definitely. There's just not enough testing supplies available at this point to find all of those cases. Now, the state is working to increase testing supplies, increase capacity, and those kinds of things. But at this point, it's very hard to know. And you could have the virus and not have any symptoms. So it's really difficult to know who does and doesn't have it. And that's why we keep educating people on the safer at home order and what that looks like.
How have people in your area been reacting to the safer at home order and the various adjustments to it? And do you find people mostly in compliance?
It's been a mixed bag, it seems, of people wanting to follow the order and not, and wanting to reopen the state. But I think the majority seem to be following the order pretty closely. We're working closely with the businesses to help make sure that they're following the order. The extended safer at home order, there's been an expansion of state golf courses being able to open. And so our public health staff has been working hard to help them do it safely while still following the recommendations.
Now, one of the reasons that we were excited to get in touch with you is because of your department's outreach to the non-English speaking community and the immigrant community in your part of Wisconsin. Talk a little bit about that effort.
So that's been a big part of my job, I would say, over this past couple weeks with responding to the pandemic. I should say more like the last month and a half. So I kind of reactivated our Facebook page in the last couple of months to help spread accurate information around COVID-19. And we're fortunate to have two staff members who speak Spanish. And so I've been working closely with them to make sure that we're getting as much as possible out there in both languages, because I know that the translator system on Facebook is just not the best. And so being able to post something in the original language for people to read is going to be a lot more effective than just relying on the translation service through Facebook.
Yeah, I looked at your Facebook page, and just with almost without exception, if there's a post in English, there's an accompanying post. Even the same graphics are remade, you know, in both English and Spanish and everything. So I could imagine that's very helpful for the people who need that service. Give me a snapshot of your area and sort of the immigrant population in your area. How many people are we talking about that could potentially need to have an outreach like that?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to know exactly based on census data that was 10 years ago. The Latino population has grown quite a bit since then. Typically, Arcadia, Independence, and kind of a bit in Whitehall is where the main Latino population is. Speaking to the numbers, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think it's something like only, 5% of the population. But it doesn't seem quite right when you're in the community. You feel like, well, that can't be an accurate representation of our Latino community. And we know that the schools have a higher percentage of Latino students than white students. And so there's quite a few who I think would benefit from this. It's a matter of getting the word out sometimes, you know, about these resources that are in existence for those communities.
What are the industries that are drawing such high level of immigrant population to your area? And are those industries like considered essential and still active?
That's a really good question, and I can't really answer that question. My health officer would probably be able to speak better to that.
Okay. But, people are familiar with the area, especially when you say Arcadia. You know, people are thinking of meat processing plants and that and those kinds of activities where I know a number of people work. And in other parts of the country, those are industries that are often staffed by immigrant populations. And there have been concerns across the country of the spread of COVID-19 in those kinds of operations. And yet in your county, there have been relatively few, by comparison, documented cases. So something must be going right in Trempealeau County.
I sure hope so. But like I said, my health officer was meeting with those businesses today and helping to make sure that there are putting in those best practices. So,
if people are looking to get in touch with the Trempealeau County Health Department, if either residents of one of your towns there, or if they're just interested in viewing the information that you've been releasing to the public, where can they find you?
So on our website, they can go to, it's co.trempealeau.wi.us/coronavirus. And there's a link for the Spanish page on that page. They can also call our hotline. So we do have a hotline available in English and Spanish. And on that hotline, we have recorded the most recent press release. So for people who maybe don't have internet access or would prefer to listen to the press release, they can go there. And they can also leave a message. And that line is 715-538-2311, extension 330. And again, it's in English and Spanish.
And if people are looking for you on social media, where can they find you?
Our social media page is called Trempealeau County Health Department.
We've been speaking with Kayla Baer, who's the Public Health Nutrition Coordinator for the Trempealeau County Health Department. Kayla, thank you very much for the information that you shared today.
Thank you so much, Ezra.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to catch up with the show, maybe find a past episode that you haven't gotten to listen to all the way through, you can listen on demand at our website. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. Show continues after this. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in the La Crosse studios of our Southwestern Bureau, and I'm glad to have with us today Senator Jennifer Schilling, who is wrapping up an accomplished legislative career. Before her joining the Senate, she was in the State Assembly, and before that, several other political experiences as a staffer and as an office holder herself, and we'll talk all about it with her. But for now, Senator, thank you very much for joining me today.
Good morning, Ezra.
Good morning to you. And so you're wrapping up your career after a combined total of about 20 years in the legislature. And tell me what that feels like. I mean, the announcement's been made. It's all over but the shouting, as they say. What does that feel like to you now that it's all kind of coming to a close?
Well, it certainly feels a little surreal. And I made my announcement in early April, April 2nd, that I was not seeking re-election. And it is very different from the way I entered the state Senate, where I entered the state Senate after recalls and protests and it was just a lot of loudness in our state at the time politically. And as I made my announcement that I would not be seeking re-election, we're in the middle of COVID-19 pandemic. The Capitol is closed to the public. No staff are in the building, or if they are, they are all physically distancing from each other. It was a very quiet, empty building when I made that announcement. I just kind of thought about that on my way home, kind of the juxtaposition of sort of my entry into the Senate and now my exit. And it feels a little incomplete exit, just because I don't know if we're going to be back on the Senate floor once again before, you know, we adjourn the session. We have one day left and we've kind of postponed that till it's safe that we can all gather again. But people's comments and letters and notes have been very kind, and I really appreciate it. I kind of joke, I feel like I'm eavesdropping on my own funeral, because people have been very kind and thoughtful in their remarks and remembering moments that maybe our paths crossed either in Madison or somewhere along the 32nd Senate District, or when I served in the Assembly at a county fair or a ribbon cutting, and meeting them and talking with their family or on their own doorstep as I went door to door. So it's been quite an interesting couple weeks, and it is kind of that walk down memory lane as I look back at pictures and things that I've been part of.
I want to go back to sort of the beginning of it all. You were comparing sort of the loudness of when you first came into the Senate, and we'll get to that part. But way before all of that, there was a beginning, and it was much younger than most people get started in politics. You were a county supervisor before you could legally drink a beer.
Yes, I was. As a student at UW-La Crosse, I ran for the county board seat that was the campus area. And really, I've been fortunate to have really great mentors and friends that I've met through UW-La Crosse, and my professors have become my lifelong friends and mentors. And Joe Heim was that professor who I had for several of my political science classes, and made a pitch that students could think about running for local office to represent the campus area, either on city council or county board. And so in the spring of 1990, he made that announcement, and I took him up on it, which surprises me as I look back, because I really was not a risk taker. I wasn't involved in student government in high school or at UWL, and for me to approach him after class and figure out how many signatures I needed and just to go door to door in the area where I lived, and ran against a gentleman who was 78 years old. I was 20. He was actually my alley neighbor and where I lived, right off of West Avenue. And that was kind of the beginning that we were successful. My parents came up on that election day, and my dad went door to door and asked people if they had voted, if they were registered. He drove people to the polls to get them registered to vote. And that's one of my fondest memories, that my mom and dad were there with me on my first election night, first victory, with my roommates and other friends. And we ended up celebrating at Howie's, is where we had a little get together. And that was a great foundation of public service, understanding the good work that county government does. And it really allowed me to apply what I was learning in my textbooks to real life as I served a term on the La Crosse County Board.
Was public service or volunteerism an ethic that was important in your family as you were growing up?
It definitely was. My parents both cast very long shadows of public service. Both my grandfathers also ran for public office, and one served as a the DA and a judge up in Waupaca County. My other grandfather was on the city council and mayor of a small town outside of Madison, Columbus, Wisconsin. My dad worked in both state and federal government, and we grew up. We moved around a lot in South Dakota. He had worked for Senator McGovern, and we went out to Washington, D.C., where he worked for then President Carter and Senator Ted Kennedy. And so when we got a little older, we moved back to the Midwest to Wisconsin, be closer to family, as we were all growing up and wanted to be near grandparents and cousins and things like that. But certainly I grew up seeing my parents really step up and volunteer and serve in their communities in very different capacities. And that certainly was something that my sisters and I, we still feel is very important. And that volunteer and serving others is something that we continue to emulate long after our parents are gone.
Your parents passed away when you were pretty young, before your later political success. Do you think, having seen that first election for county board, do you think that they would have been surprised to see you run for office later, or do you think they got an inkling that this is what your future might hold?
I know they'd be very proud. I don't know if maybe not surprised, but I'm sure that they would. My dad would have, both my parents would have been so happy. My dad worked in state government. He worked for, at the time, Governor Marty Schreiber. He also worked for Secretary of State Val Phillips when we lived in Madison. And so my dad worked in state government. I remember my mom bringing my sisters and I to the Capitol for the swearing in of Marty Schreiber, Governor Schreiber, after Governor Lucy, Patrick Lucy, was appointed ambassador to Mexico by the president. And so I have fond memories of sitting down January of 1993, and I had just gotten a job at the Capitol as a staff person to then Representative Mark Meyer. And I sat down and I penned a letter to my dad, just saying I was super proud and excited to start service in the state and start at the Capitol, and just being very proud of the work that he had done. And many of the people that I came across knew my dad and worked with him. And so it was just a special continuation of that that desire to serve and to work in state government and be part of public policy. And so that building is very special, that there are not many people in our state's history that have that opportunity to step up and work or serve there in the Capitol.
You worked in different kinds of capacities in the early years for Ron Kind, who's still in office, for Mark Meyer, as you mentioned, who you later succeeded in office. Talk about the influences of either those gentlemen or whoever else influenced the early path of your political career.
Like I said, I've been really fortunate to have fantastic mentors that have helped me, both men and women, as I look across kind of the political spectrum and the areas that I've been able to work in. But after graduating from college and working, Mark Meyer continues to be a really good friend of mine, and having worked with him, moving back to La Crosse and working for Congressman Ron Kind, and just both of them really have a strong work ethic. It's that idea of bipartisanship, working together and traveling and listening to constituents to be able to really reflect their viewpoints and kind of where your communities are at. Jim Cruiser, he was a state representative. He's now the Kenosha County Executive, is a good friend of mine, and I have turned to him for advice as I became the leader and looking to see how I manage the caucus, and he had been the assembly leader when I served there. And locally, Tara Johnson has been a good friend and mentor to me. And I was just looking through some old file cabinets and came across her first piece of campaign literature when she ran for county board in 2000. She announced her decision not to seek re-election earlier this year. And so it really seems like it's come full circle, and I look to a lot of good people who have I've sought out their advice over the years. John Menninger is another one. But also I was just reflecting that I've had a good friendship with the colleagues in the delegation. And so Mike Hipsch and I served in the assembly together. He was appointed to Governor Walker's cabinet, and we still continue to be good friends and touch base. And I appreciate that reaching across the aisle. I've always wanted to make sure that we see each other as kind of co-workers first down there in the Capitol. People want us to get along and work together on issues. And I've been one where relationships have been important to me, that we can have our moments on the floor and agree to disagree, but it really is about relationships for me. And after hours, being able to get together and have dinner or get together on weekends back in the district is really important.
My guest today is Senator Jennifer Schilling of La Crosse, who is leaving office after about a decade in the Senate and another decade before that in the Assembly. And we will continue our conversation with Senator Schilling after this. If you'd like to learn more about our program or perhaps catch a past episode, you can stream it on our website. It's wpr.org/newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our southwestern studios, and I thank you for joining us today. Our guest is State Senator Jennifer Schilling, who is retiring from her seat in the Senate, not seeking re-election, that is to say. And Senator, you're too young to be retiring from very much. You may not be seeking re-election, but tell me what it is that's drawing you to spend more time at home in La Crosse.
Well, 20 years is a long time, and this is really the only lifestyle that my husband and our two boys know. And they are 11 and 14, so a middle school and well, entering middle school, and will be a sophomore in high school. And I just know that our time together as a family is fading. And so I could not have done this the last 20 years without the love and support of my husband, Chris, who has stepped up in so many ways, as well as the support of the kids. Chris's parents live in the area and have been a tremendous support as well, Jim and Kathy. And so I just really wanted to find new ways to serve here in the community. And it was bittersweet because I have really enjoyed the issues that I have worked on. I have enjoyed meeting people throughout the state and particularly in western Wisconsin. But just it's not the Senate or the legislature is certainly not a life sentence. And just wanted to see, you know, what else there is, other opportunities out there for our family.
In the legislature, you've had a chance to see a lot of movement and change in the political system over the last 20 years. What are the proudest moments of your own legislative career as you look back over the last 20 years?
Well, I think some of the proudest moments are those that we worked on here in the La Crosse area, maybe as a delegation, and it really was not a partisan thing, and we would check our D's and R's at the door and work together on things. I am a proud graduate of UW-La Crosse, so every opportunity to support the university that I had in the legislature, I was proud to do that and had a fantastic experience. I want to pay that forward for the faculty, the staff, and students who are enrolled there at UWL. So some of the changes that we have seen just with taxpayer support for building projects on campus, the growth, quality, and access, which was something that was really new at the time about kind of differential tuition, that was something that I'm proud to be part of and what we were able to do to add jobs as well as look at just the future of UWL. I've been excited. I served on the health committee and seeing some of the changes in health care and just the modernization of some of the hospitals in our area. Both, you know, Prairie du Chien has a new hospital. Hillsborough has building a new hospital. Toma recently completed theirs. We've had additions at Gunderson and Mayo. So those were kind of the issues that I worked on in the assembly, and I am proud to see that, as well as support for the Hmong community here in La Crosse, that the Hmong community culture was a project and a partnership with the state, as well as the Myrick Eco Park, and also looking as of infrastructure of broadband expansion throughout western Wisconsin. And that's something when I entered the Senate, I quickly asked for a map of broadband connection throughout the state, and there are areas in western Wisconsin that were really lacking. And so really wanting to try to be a voice and a champion for connectivity and just the important role that broadband and bandwidth has. It's certainly now with a COVID-19 situation, we find ourselves that being connected and through broadband, and now with some of the schools going online, it really is important in that connectivity that we have. So I look back and really am proud of some of the ideas that that citizens came forward, brought forward, and shared with me that we could do some things with domestic violence and address confidentiality was an issue that a woman brought forward to me to work on, as well as something with HIV, modernization and research through our hospitals and collection of data.
Let's play woulda, coulda, shoulda for a minute. There's got to be something that either you wish you might have approached differently or some issue that never really got the traction that you wanted to see that you might have been pushing for. What's one of those items that you wish you could have pushed a little harder or gotten a little farther down the field?
Yeah, I think that question, that one is a personal one for me, and I will say just because people know my background, that I lost both of my parents, that they were murdered in our family restaurant in 1993. And so I didn't talk about that a lot in the legislature, just my experience with gun violence. And when Governor Evers wanted to tackle gun violence in our communities and look for ways that we could step up and have some safer communities and homes and schools and things like that, that I really I regret that we weren't able to do more on background checks and things like that when it comes to that issue. And I know that one is a polarizing issue. It's a personal one for me. And I spoke about my parents' murder in the assembly in the middle of the night one night when we found ourselves talking about concealed carry in the state of Wisconsin. And many people didn't know my story that night. And now over in the Senate, I've talked about it a little bit more freely as we talk about gun violence in our communities and what's happening in our schools. And certainly I wish we could have done more. I appreciate Governor Evers' leadership on calling a special session on gun safety. I appreciate the Attorney General, Josh Call, also stepping up to talk about what we could do for background checks and some other things. And so I wish in my 20 years that we were able to move that a little bit further. Just as I meet people across the state and they have lost loved ones from gun violence, that we all know that pain is the same, and I wish we could have done more on that.
That's an issue that you talked about it being polarizing. There's just really almost no crossover between the different parties on issues related to any time you have any kind of legislation related to guns. There's almost no crossover between the parties. What advice might you offer, or what approach do you think, is there an approach that hasn't been tried yet in terms of bridging that gap or finding compromise?
Well, I certainly have seen sort of the move to a harder partisan tone on issues, and that is difficult too. We've seen the increase of the role that money has in our elections. We have seen the role of gerrymandering, and we need to make sure that when we do redistricting that these are fair maps, because that certainly has a long-term effect over, I think, sort of the workability of and the productivity of the legislature being able to find common ground on issues. I have tried to be one with civility and respect to the institution and recognizing the role that I have serving in the state Senate, serving as the Democratic leader for the minority party, and to make sure that I can have those friendships, relationships with other legislative leaders, either in the Senate or the Assembly. And so We still need good people to step up and run who want to serve for the right reasons, who remember who they are serving back home as the constituents that they are, that voice. I remember one time as I was meeting people on the campaign trail that I introduced myself and I was running for state assembly and I was a Democrat, and the woman had said, I'm not going to vote for you. And I said, well, if I'm fortunate enough to earn people's support, you know, I will represent you as well, meaning that if she had an issue that she needed to contact the office, maybe, you know, if they don't support, if they haven't voted for me, I'm still willing to listen, help them out, and be open. And I think sometimes we don't do enough listening to our colleagues. We don't listen to the constituents, and sometimes it just gets difficult. And I've really appreciated the leadership style of servant leadership and recognizing who I serve and the way that I want to conduct myself as I move forward and represent Western Wisconsin.
The seat in the 32nd, you are vacating it, but it doesn't go away. It seems to be a race shaping up now. Some time ago, Dan Kopanky, your former opponent, in fact, the person who you won the recall election against in 2011 to gain that seat in the first place, is running for it again on the Republican side. And this week announced a Democratic candidate, Brad Paff, announced that he would be seeking that office as well, and has already garnered some good attention from higher level members in your party, including I think Ron Kind and others. So, what's your assessment of the race for your soon to be former seat?
Yeah, I'm excited for Brad that he has announced that he is willing to step up and serve. Has a real sincere interest and energy. Obviously, he is a local, you know, hometown folk who grew up on a family farm here in North La Crosse County and has a long, distinguished career of serving. So it'll be interesting. It certainly is. He has got the experience. It is both kind of a rematch of a while ago. I would say I think Dan Kopanky and I are probably the only two political folks that probably have a relationship that include a recall and a recount. And had I decided to run, it would have felt like a rematch this fall. But I'm excited for Brad's energy and his enthusiasm. And again, wanting to work in a bipartisan fashion and find these solutions and be a problem solver to figure out how we have good, strong schools here and safe roads and how we save family farms and how we step up for an economy and small businesses that are really hurting right now. So there'll be a lot at stake in the state Senate. That the governor's veto that the Republicans need to win just three seats. And so certainly an important time that we need to make sure as I'm exiting that I want to make sure that I can still help my colleagues either flip seats or to retain the seats, because it'll come down to being able to protect Governor Evers' veto in the state Senate.
Senator Schilling, I certainly thank you for joining us today. And as we draw our interview to a close, I certainly want to congratulate you on your years of public service and thank you for your time today, but also your service throughout the years, and wish you very well as your future goes forward.
Well, thank you very much. And as I told my family, we can still get out to the county fairs and the dairy breakfast. We love the Westby ski jump. And the Kickapoo Valley Reserve down in the Lafarge area. So I'll be returning as a private citizen to attend a lot of the festivities, fairs, and festivals that we've enjoyed over the last 20 years.
Well, that'll be interesting, and hopefully we'll run into each other then. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Senator Jennifer Schilling, who is leaving office after combined 20 years in the Assembly and the Senate, the former minority leader in the Senate, not seeking re-election this year. That's Newsmakers for today. You can catch our show every Friday at 10 a.m. on the Ideas Network 90.3 in La Crosse, and Saturdays at 5 a.m. and 6 p.m. on La Crosse's 88.9 WLSU. You can always stream our show online at wpr.org/newsmakers, and you can subscribe to our podcast by searching for Newsmakers in your favorite podcasting application. For my producer, John Davis, I'm Ezra Wall. Please join us again next time for Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.